with a question which is apparently very simple, but not so simple. It's abstract as well as practical. Men have different reasons for serving humanity and their country and so on. What are yours, Your Highness?
Well, I think first of all, my interpretation of my faith and my office. I was brought up from an early stage as a Muslim. I served my family, practicing Islam. I was educated from a very early age in the faith. I studied the faith as a university student. And my interpretation is that any man who is in a position of authority has a duty to use that authority and whatever wealth he has for the benefit of the Ummah and of humanity. And that is part of the essence of Islam. It is the way in which the faith defines the role of the wealthy and the powerful in relation to society. And that is a profound part of our belief.
To what extent this belief you refer to, Your Highness, has influenced your judgment in your philanthropic work, for example?
A great deal. In fact, it is the motivating force by excellence. That is the force which has encouraged me to look at various areas of help. I think that there are two forms of help. There is helping people without instigating them to help themselves.
Yes.
And then there is helping people by helping them help themselves. And I prefer the second form. I believe it is also the intent in a lot of what is said in the Quran and in the tradition, that you don't help people once. You try to help them in such a way that they become self-sufficient.
Yes.
And then they can help others.
Yes. You have known the best of the Occident and the Orient, such as being your background, your education, and your upbringing. What have you discovered to be the best in the field of education?
Yes. I think in terms of, let's say, the philosophical environment in which an individual lives, there's no doubt that the faith of Islam places the individual in society, in the world in which he lives, in a position where he is not in conflict with his time, and he's not in conflict with the science and technology of his time. The time values of Islam are such that whether the man lived 100 years ago or lives 100 years from now, he is always in his correct position. There is no conflict. So in terms of the humanistic permanent values of a faith, I would say that obviously Islam puts an individual in a very privileged position. In the Occident, what I have found challenging and interesting is the concept of change and the acceptance that the world does evolve, society evolves, man himself evolves, and the concept of the static individual and the static society and the static civilization is totally in conflict with Western philosophy.
As Cyril von Schopling might as they say, you cannot step into the same river twice.
That's right. That's right. And I think that what I find so inspiring is that Islam is the bridge between those two philosophies.
How does it get, why do you call it a bridge? Sometimes, just for the sake of argument, why is it that we find this blend of the best and the east, the best technology and our moral values and spiritual values? Why do we manage to find or discover a blend of the two?
I think it probably stems from a number of factors. First of all, I don't think that science and technology has ever existed in a vacuum. It exists in a society. And it only survives in a society if that society needs combines the science and technology and uses the science and technology and invests in it. Therefore, science and technology per se are areas of difficult development in countries which do not have a strong industrial sector, which are basically rural, whose demography is rural. And I think that this whole issue of science and technology is intimately linked with the productive industrial sector of a country. If that doesn't function, and after all, it is that sector which does, in most industrialized countries, more than 50% of the investment in research and development comes from the industrial sector.
Well, putting in a somewhat personal note, you are the spiritual leader, the moral leader, and of course the temporal leader as well of a very large community in the world. But now we see that you have the spiritual leadership on one side, moral guidance on one side, and of course the establishment of a purely scientific and technological university on the other. And you'll be able to find some blend between the two.
Well, because I've tried to give this institution a mandate which is within Islamic philosophy, within the faith of Islam, but interpreting the mandate in such a way that the university can evolve, can grow.
Now, as Chancellor of the University, what do you envisage to be the future of Pakistan's young generation?
I think it's a difficult question. I mean, first of all, I start from the premise of Pakistan. A big country, a big population, a spread of Muslims from all interpretations of the faith, a rural country with a reasonably developed industrial sector, but not an extensively developed industrial sector. That makes me think of a country whose development could and inshallah will be multifaceted, not a monolithic economy, not a monolithic society, perhaps not even a monolithic interpretation of the faith. In that sense, Pakistan represents the multifaceted face of the Islamic world.
Yes.
Therefore, within its frontiers, it contains all the challenges, all the opportunities of the Islamic world. What I hope is that in this diversity, there will be a sense of strength rather than a sense of antagonism or conflict. And that sense of strength, which could come from many different peoples, many different attitudes, is perhaps one of the greatest opportunities. Difficulty is what needs to be done so that the youth in Pakistan interpret this situation as one of tremendous, perhaps even unique opportunity.
Opportunity, as you say, of course, not just for the youth to take it and make the best use of it. This is subject very close to your heart, and that is architecture. You are the first known architect to receive the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Medal of Architecture, and you have created the largest architectural award in the world. In what way does this intense involvement reflect the cause of Islam?
Well, one of my concerns in thinking about the future of the Islamic world in the years to come is whether we have sufficiently interpreted the fact that Islam is a complete faith. Touches every aspect of man's life, not only his spiritual life, but his contact with his environment, with his family, with the world around him. That fact was translated for centuries into some of the greatest architecture in the world, recognized by all civilizations, not just by us. And not only was it an inspiration for buildings related to the practice of the faith,
yes,
but for secular buildings. Now, for a number of reasons, and perhaps essentially the fact that the economic center moved out of the Islamic empire into other parts of the world, the views of Islamic society start to be progress is related to the physical forms of our society.
Oh, yes.
And there was, a gradual degradation, lack of appreciation for our own traditions. And I think that insofar as my conviction is that Islam is a total faith, all aspects of that faith's action and man's behavior must be taken into account.
Yes.
And the way in which man lives in society and in his environment is critical. And in that sense, reviving Islamic architecture, adapted to our times, I think is very important.
Sure, of course, we talk of the classical heritage of Islam, as you're referring to that, and of course the rapid, endless innovations of modern architecture. There's some really strange buildings, that we see, we come across these in our television programs as well sometimes, from the West. Now, do you think it is possible to create a meaningful blend of the two in the future? Or would they just go in different directions and...
I think there is strength in diversity. Let me re-explain that. I don't think that the type of architecture you will get in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia will be identical to the type of architecture you get in the Gulf.
Yes.
I don't think the Gulf will be identical to the architecture you get in the mountains of Windsor and Chitral.
Yes.
You will always have a local element in that
architecture.
I'm looking at the inspiration behind that. What is man's relationship to his family? What is man's relationship to his environment? God's blessings in the forms of water, sand, color, how are those used? How do we use them to improve our living conditions? Those, I think, are the inspiring forces that Islamic architects, Muslim architects will revitalize. Now, I hope they will revitalize this in a form which is appropriate to their own culture, their own climate, their own environment. But the inspiration is there.
Why just this stagnation? I mean, you were talking of the revival, which means that there was some form of stagnation for a couple of centuries. For example, if you talk of the Indo-Pakistan subcontinent, we think of the Mughal architecture, and now we think of the present day architecture, and in between, there doesn't seem to be any particular development or evolution.
So I think there are probably a number of reasons. Probably one of them is that the large institutional buildings for many years were not part of the Islamic Empire because the Islamic Empire was losing its wealth. Wealth was moving elsewhere. Because wealth had moved elsewhere, the high-impact buildings were being developed in other societies.
Yes.
And there was a form of feeling that that was the physical form that power and wealth had to take. I think new materials had a lot to do with it. The development of steel, concrete, aluminium, glass, these were all foreign to Islamic architecture in its traditional forms. So I think there are a number of reasons, but I think the exciting part about it is that Muslim architects are reutilizing these materials and their own indigenous materials in forms which come back to the inspiration of the science.
So this is where we talk of the blend.
That's where I think the blend will occur.
Now this, in case we come back to education, of course, this other community is a very great gift.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have anything, some specific reason in mind why choosing Pakistan for it? I would be very interested to know, and I'm sure our viewers would like to know, that such a huge and magnificent complex that we have there. Why Pakistan?
Well, let me go back to the genesis of the problem. In 1964, there was an insufficiency of facilities for training doctors in Pakistan. And there was a request that I should assist, as I had done in other parts of the world, to develop a teaching hospital. This I did, and yesterday I explained some of the reasons why that teaching hospital changed from a teaching hospital to an independent university with a charter which enabled it to develop faculties even outside Pakistan if necessary. why I started with the teaching hospital in 1964, why I accepted that, is that we already have in Pakistan a very large network of health units. They had no focal point. They had no apex health institution. Now, that was a Pakistani concept. But then, with the president, we started asking the questions of where is Pakistan within the Ummah? And what should a new university in Pakistan be in relation to the Ummah and in relation to the Third World? From their concepts expanded to what the institution is today.
You see. Of course, we have the resources, and I understand that this university starts with, by the grace of God, with great resources. We will not be short of funds or skill or devotion. And of course, as you say, we have the intellectual vigor. And yet we lag behind the West. I keep coming back to it because we have never been able to quite resolve what the main causes could be. We lag behind the West, nevertheless, in many ways, in the quality of our life. Perhaps, in many speaking, the quality of our thinking sometimes. Are we indolent given work, or are we pessimistic? Or is it, Your Highness, that we do not have the kind of unity we want to have in the Ummah, so that all of us could get together, pool our resources? What would be the main cause of it?
I'm not sure I could say what is the main cause. I think there are a number of factors which have influenced this. I think the first thing is that we are dealing with problems which are not problems of the industrialized world. Let me give you an example. The population of Pakistan is 70% rural. The population of China is more than 70% rural. That population produces probably 100% of the agricultural product of the country. In the United States, less than 2.5% of the population is agricultural. And it produces 100% of the agricultural produce. So in the first place, we're talking about different lands and different demographies. I think in the second place, there has been a swing of economic development after the Ottoman Empire fell apart. Wealth moved to other parts of the world. And that wealth induced a new civilization, an industrial civilization. That generated more wealth. The Islamic world is now part of that.
Yes.
And therefore, in a sense, we have been removed from recent economic development. Our difficulty today is that we cannot simply blindly seek to recreate the same forms of wealth as the industrialized world, because our land is different, our people are different. So we have to find new solutions. I think that is one problem. I think the other problem is, as you said, a lack of integrity in view. Every country, for historical reasons, very often has been under different influences. Many countries were under French governments in the last century, others under British governments, and so on and so forth. That has not allowed an integral view of the Islamic Ummah. I think that's another reason. I think perhaps the third reason is that we have been faced with a historical question. How does government change in an Islamic country?
Yes.
What are the political forms which are acceptable within Islam, acceptable within our time? How do they function? And that has caused a large number of different forms of government, of processes of change, some inherited, some new. The fact is that there has been a lot of change. That destabilizes, it breaks continuity and development. I think we have to try and find solutions to that problem.
Well, before I ask you another question, perhaps something slightly less creative and more interesting, in a manner of speaking to the viewers, what, Your Highness, has been the most pleasant moment of your life?
The most pleasant moment of my life. Man's mind is not perfect, and to reconstitute all the important events in our life would be very difficult. I think what is important in any man's life is the satisfaction he gets from what he does, and certainly yesterday was one of the important days in my life, because it is not given to every man to create a new university. It is not given to every man to receive the sort of support that I think this university has received. It is not given to every man to sell, or maybe an institution has come into existence that might one day have a significant impact on people who are important in their life.
In other words, you'd like to see grow in front of you. And you did pay tribute to your team, which was really very kind of you. Very realistic, because it's really the team
of course,
we have our friends here who have been working for many hours. I have just come over here and asked your Highness these questions. They're the ones who have put the whole thing together. There is one thing left, perhaps, because there are many things left, because in your life it's just impossible to contain it. In the dream, the renaissance of Islam, and all your activities really converge on that particular point. But what makes you believe it will become a reality?
Simply because I believe in the alternative of faith, and I believe it is the faith to man. And in that sense, I think that Muslims will find within their faith all the dimensions they need to live satisfactorily in the future. The question is not one of the faith, it's the question of what man does. Faith gives him the environment in which to function, today and tomorrow. It is what we do as individuals in our lives.
How do you resolve this then? It is just a thought comes to my mind. That people who do not have the faith of Islam, who have their own faiths, maybe the men of the book or not the men of the book, followers of holy books, and they have made great progress. Faith will be great faith, and true faith will be the foundation.
I would question what you interpret, or what are the elements you put in the word progress.
I would like to hear your
there are many aspects of the industrialized world, as it's called today, which I don't wish for the future of the Islamic world, nor for my own children. I think there are imbalances there, which of course exist in other societies. But there are imbalances there which I don't think are healthy, which I would wish changed, which I would hope Islamic society in the future will address and find different forms, perhaps better forms of solutions. So I don't think one can equate progress exclusively with what's happening in the industrialized world, no. Very far from it.
And what would be your ideal worldview of the future of Islam? What kind of world Islam as a faith and followers of Islam would envisage, where really you could say that yes, this is an Islamic country, the best of its ideals and practices?
Well, I would like the essence of the faith to be more predominant in everyone's life. Go back to the origins of Islam. As a faith practiced in a land with no physical fences, the concept of the modern state is not really an Islamic concept. Islam is a brotherhood, is a brotherhood. That's the first thing. The free movement of people, the generosity of people's attitudes towards their brothers around the world, that in itself, I think, is important. Secondly, living in the context of the moral discipline of Islam, I think is important. Because living in a society where freedom eventually becomes equated with license is not what I would want.
Yes. Well, yes, this has been very interesting. There are many questions that come to my mind, which I would prefer to leave for the next interview. You have been very kind. I'm sure that our viewers must have enjoyed, really enjoyed. I should have thought this interview was more instructive and educative than happy, because I think that one or two personal questions remain and those will leave for the next time. Your Highness, is there anything else you'd like to tell our viewers?
Yes, I think on the occasion of the opening of the university, I would like to thank everyone in Pakistan and everyone connected with Pakistan outside the country who has enabled this institution to come into existence, because I have a very deep feeling of gratitude. A man, whoever he is, cannot create institutions of this sort without that sort of help and support. And I hope hope and pray that it will continue because its growth and strength will come from further support.
Thank you very much, Your Highness. Thank you.